This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
This is a WTOP original podcast.
Coming up in this episode of Target USA.
The war in Sudan. We talk with Jock Maddock-Jock, an anthropology professor at Syracuse University, about the latest.
Really, I don't think this war in Sudan really sinks in into the lives of everyday people who are themselves struggling.
Coming up on this episode of Target USA.
The National Security Podcast.
From WTOP in Washington, D.C., this is Target USA. Russia
could render huge harm to this country.
North Korea's secret missile
capable of reaching the whole of the United States.
Dangerous terrorist.
DC is repeatedly mentioned as someplace they would like to seek an attack.
Cyber criminals.
Decryption successful.
America has a target on its back. And on this program, we investigate the threats, the people behind them, the agencies fighting them, and the impact on you. This is Target USA,
the National Security Podcast.
I'm J.J. Green.
The war in Sudan has taken a lot of twists and turns. There have been several ceasefires. Peace negotiations are underway, but it doesn't seem like any of it is working. Now we talk with an expert from the region who's there now. Professor Jock Maddock-Jock, you have joined us before and talked to us very eloquently about the situation in Sudan. Thank you again for joining us.
Thank you, sir. Happy to do it.
Professor, you're in East Africa now, and I'm wondering what the situation is there in the minds of the people you see wherever it is you are.
Well, I'm in Nairobi, Kenya, and I would say at the governmental level, there is quite a lot of concern about what is going on in Sudan. The likelihood of the conflict in Sudan leading to a sort of unraveling of that country, even if it's only temporarily. And so there is quite a bit of conversation going on between heads of states of IGAD countries, which Kenya is a member of, about what to do with Sudan. But at the level of ordinary people, I have spent a lot of time today in Nairobi Business District, and I have talked to a lot of my colleagues in the media and in policy and activist groups. And it seems like, people are concerned about the humanitarian shocking images of Khartoum being destroyed and people having to flee and people having to be holed up in their homes without food and no water and no electricity. And the prospects of humanitarian interventions are being thwarted by the ongoing conflict, despite the ceasefire in Khartoum. So people are maybe concerned at that level, but really, I don't think this war in Sudan really sinks in into the with the lives of everyday people who are themselves struggling. There is quite a bit of economic decline in Kenya and a bit of inflation, and ordinary people are struggling themselves. So I don't think the war in any country in the region rises up to the level of being an everyday, every street concern.
That's very unfortunate. It's sad to hear. What would it take for people in other places, like maybe South America, Canada, Europe, here in the U.S., to actually empathize with the folks there in Sudan?
And that is really what activists and news people and humanitarian aid workers are trying to do. not just to bear witness to the mayhem in Sudan, but to also enlighten the world about this tragedy in hope that it becomes an important issue for ordinary folks, and to urge them to speak to their lawmakers and their and the government people in their countries, such that the tragedy in Sudan becomes a global garners a global attention that it should. But you know, there are competing problems in the world. The war in Ukraine is a big problem. The situation in Yemen and in Syria are still unmitigated. And so, yeah, this is there is certainly competing views, competing problems. But also, I think I am not, I don't want to dumb down on people's ability to think for others and be in the shoes of others. But I think there is generally a kind of a problem fatigue that we are being bombarded with images of suffering from all corners of the world these days.
Yeah, you know, I've heard that as well from colleagues in Ukraine and in other places where there are conflicts going on. So hopefully our conversation and the others that are going on will reach some corners and generate some kind of more activity and more connection and more solidarity on this. But to the situation in Sudan, how would you assess it today?
Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture, and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
The situation continues to be very dire for ordinary people. I have personal contacts in all of the major cities of Sudan, Khartoum for sure, but also Madani and Kadarif and Port Sudan, and various cities in Darfur like El Janina or Nyala or El Fasher. And the story is the same, that the warring parties, the Sudan Armed Forces and the Rapid Support Forces continue to battle it without any concern for the consequences, about the consequences of their fighting for the people. So that right now, humanitarian aid is arriving on the shores of Sudan at the Red Sea, and it's still quite difficult to get it to the people, most especially in Khartoum. Meanwhile, the peace talks and the talks on possibility of cessation of hostilities don't seem to progress. There was a ceasefire sign with caveats. So caveated that it's almost useless, because the RSF continues to fight in urban war, in major towns in Darfur and in Khartoum. The Sudan Armed Forces has been almost limited to using the Air Force to bomb the RSF positions, which obviously means massive collateral damage in lives and property. So the situation doesn't seem to look up. The only thing that is holding the Sudan up right now is the resilience of the Sudanese people themselves. However much besieged they are, they seem to continue to push on day by day and to leave if they can, and to to support each other as much as they can. Right now, one curious situation in the riverine central Sudan is the fact that we don't have IDP camps as you would have seen in other wars. The reason for this is that people have opened their homes to strangers so that they don't have to sleep in open spaces. And my friend in Madani tells me that her family's compound is now housing hundreds of people just sleeping outside in the fence, inside the fence. But they have no food and have no water. So people will surely die, not to say anything about medicine. Doctors there are trying their best to keep treating people, but there are no medicines to give to people. The situation is dire for those with chronic illnesses such as heart conditions, diabetes, and others that require constant care and constant medication. I don't think anything has changed since the announcement of the US and Saudi Arabia sponsored ceasefire. Only the Sudanese people themselves just trying to make do with the little they have by sharing it.
Professor, do you believe that those that are trying to broker this ceasefire and all of the observers in other countries that have some stake in this, do you believe there is more that they can do to stop this fighting?
Oh, most certainly. The Arab League had a meeting some days ago to discuss the position of Syria, which had been kicked out previously on the basis of its war against the rebels. And the Sudan conflict didn't come up in the meeting of the Arab League, which was rather tragic and curious. This is probably related to Sudan itself becoming a turf war between some Arab countries like Egypt that support the government, the Sudan Armed Forces, and countries like UAE and Saudi Arabia that have in the past supported the Rapid Support Forces. So the more divided the international opinion on the country, the less likely more will come, more positive interventions will come. There is always more to be done through the United Nations and donor countries that have pledged support. The UN made a humanitarian appeal for $1 billion for the next 3 months. They only got $200 million. So the donations that have been received so far will pale compared to the magnitude of the problem. Now, this is a country that was already facing massive humanitarian challenges as it was before the war. Out of the 46 million Sudanese, 4 million people were already receiving food aid and were going to need more. With IDPs all over Darfur, with the refugees on the southern borders with South Sudan, there was always going to be more aid needed. But with this now, it multiplied several folds. And so the scale of need is going to far outweigh the international goodwill. So I don't know whether more help will come, or whether people will tire of Sudan soon, because even as we speak, It's no longer on the spotlight as it used to be, as it was a month ago when the war started.
Yeah. Professor, what do you think it would take for the two sides to stop this fighting? I mean, we know that obviously they both want to win.
Right.
But is there something short of that, that the two sides, based on what you see, can agree on to stop this?
Unfortunately, so long as each side has the stamina and military equipment and willing fighters, they are not going to stop fighting. And I don't think anybody can stop them either, because peace can only come when the fighters want peace, because nobody can make them accept peace. So what is going to, there are two things that are going to potentially influence the direction of this war. One is the Sudan Armed Forces simply refusing to fight, as they see this war is not their war. This is not a war where a soldier is going to war to protect the constitution of his or her country. This is not a war where Sudan was aggressed from outside. This is not a war of with any conviction about the need for it. So when the war is like that, I think there will come a time when the Sudanese fighters will simply say, enough is enough, we cannot fight anymore. But usually that sort of situation is reached after so much damage has already been done in human lives and in property. The pictures coming out of Khartoum don't encourage me to think that these people can be reined in by the potential for their destruction of their country. That's one possibility if soldiers refuse to fight, as they see the war as not being their war. The second possibility, of course, is negotiated settlement. And this can only come when mediators, potential mediators, be this the United States or Kingdom of Saudi Arabia or UAE or IGAD or the African Union or the UN itself, when they actually do have a stick and a carrot. And until the fighting parties see the potential for being given a carrot rather than a stick on their head, maybe one day will force them to stop the fighting. Right now, it doesn't look like there is any of that.
Yeah.
Third thing that is going to potentially change the dynamic is the economic situation. Right now, the Sudan Armed Forces are still able to get money, support from other countries like Egypt, support from friendly countries in the Arab world. Hameti and his Rapid Support Force had amassed quite a bit of resources from the sale of gold to the money given to them by al-Bashir when they were his own protection, when they were forces doing the dirty work of al-Bashir, like genocide and war crimes in peripheries. And until they run out of money, I don't see any reason why they should stop fighting, why they want to stop fighting. because they are convinced, each side is convinced they're going to win against the other and capture the other person or kill them.
Yeah. Well, that's, again, tragic. But that's also why we talk to you, because you can tell it like it is, and we can show our listeners and viewers how it is. Professor, I know it's late.
Right.
Thank you for taking time again to talk with us, to speak with us about this, and we hope to stay in touch with you about this.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it. Good day.
That's it for this episode of Target USA. Coming up in our next episode,
another look at some serious new threats to U.S. national security.
That's coming up on the next episode of Target USA. In the meantime, if you have any questions or comments about the program, send me an email. You can reach me at jgreen@wtop.com. The letter J, the color green, one word, at Whiskey Tango Oscar Papa. jgreen@wtop.com. Also, please subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Twitter. We're at TUSA Podcast. That's at Tango Uniform Sierra Alpha Podcast. And if you want more national security news, you can sign up for my newsletter. It's called Inside the SCIF, and you can sign up at WTOP.com/email.
I'm JJ Green, and this is Target USA,
the National Security Podcast.